off to an incredible start.
These athletes are now inspiring others.
You cannot be serious!
Let's go, FIFA! Let's go!
Anytime you're meeting somebody who's the best at anything, it's impressive.
Hold on a second, let's double check this.
I don't know if it's necessarily the best, but...
This is The Ticket.
Hello, welcome to The Ticket. I'm Tracy Holmes. After a months-long intense campaign targeting the World Anti-Doping Agency, the organisation responds with significant changes to its governance. But are they significant enough for the critics, which include athletes and national anti-doping agencies? This week's episode of The Ticket is Future-Proofing WADA. Following this week's foundation board meeting in Azerbaijan, we caught up with the Director General of WADA, Olivier Nigli, who says the critics should be reassured and says there's more change to come. Our panel questions why athletes aren't at the heart of every anti-doping conversation. And a senior clinical scientist does the numbers on performance-enhancing drugs and finds very little evidence that many of them actually do what they claim, and he thinks athletes should be told. Future-proofing WADA today on The Ticket, but first, a quick look at the week that was. Do you reckon there's more room in the tennis calendar for one more event? No? Guess what? A men's teams event known as the ATP World Teams Cup will begin in January 2020, held across three Australian host cities. It's seen as a threat to the International Tennis Federation's revamped Davis Cup, which will launch next November. World number one Novak Djokovic is a supporter of the ATP Cup, but thinks it's madness to have two similar events held just 6 weeks apart.
We're just adding events and we kind of have to try to focus on quality rather than quantity.
What about if you have quality and quantity? Well, that'd be LeBron James breaking into the top five scorers in NBA history this week with his 44 game points, enough to climb over Hall of Famer Wilt Chamberlain with a career tally of 31,425.
Move over Wilt. Make room for LeBron. James, number five all-time on the NBA scoring list.
Does it get any more American than this? Miami Heat NBA center Hassan Whiteside had a brand new $69,000 assault rifle stolen from his $500,000 Rolls Royce moments after making the purchase. It was apparently pinched when he left his car unlocked in the car park at the gun store. The firearm was eventually found in a stolen vehicle a few weeks later.
I will never, ever infringe on the right of the people to keep and bear arms.
The 2021 Women's Rugby World Cup is heading down under to New Zealand. The Kiwis beat us again, this time polling 25 votes to Australia's 17 to become the first nation in the Southern Hemisphere to host the tournament. Rugby Australia CEO Raylene Castle has promised to continue investing in the Wallaroos despite the unsuccessful bid.
It doesn't change anything from developing our Wallaroos team. It just means now that we won't be playing on home soil, we'll be going across the Tasman.
There could be little cause for concern over cyber safety at the 2020 Tokyo Olympics. The man responsible for that area, Yoshitaka Sakurada, has admitted he's never used a computer in his life. The 68-year-old was appointed Japan's new cyber security minister last month, and he left his colleagues dumbfounded when he told Parliament he orders his employees to use computers when needed, and he didn't seem to understand what a USB was.
To start, press any key. Where's the any key?
There doesn't seem to be any key.
And a football referee has paid a hefty price for engaging in a humble schoolyard game. David McNamara accidentally left his coin in the dressing room ahead of the Women's Super League match between Manchester City and Reading last month. So instead of a coin toss to determine playing ends and kick-off, he asked the captains to do rock, paper, scissors. England's Football Association didn't approve of the hijinks. It's banned McNamara for 21 days for not acting in the best interests of the game.
The laws are obsolete and they're incompetent. They are the worst laws any country has anywhere in the world.
And that is the week that was.
The Ticket.
When one of the sports world's greats, Olympian Edwin Moses, sends a letter to the President and Director General of WADA complaining of marginalisation, a lack of respect and denigrating conduct, you think it might cause some concern. On the eve of WADA's foundation board meeting in Azerbaijan this week, a four-page letter was emailed by Edwin Moses to Sir Craig Reedy and Olivier Nigli at WADA, requesting an independent and thorough investigation into the culture of the organisation. It was the latest in a months-long sustained campaign built around WADA's September decision to allow the Moscow anti-doping lab back into the fold, despite not having met a number of the criteria originally set in place after evidence of Russia's state-sanctioned doping program emerged. It seems, though, that WADA's been listening. The Foundation Board unanimously adopted a series of governance changes that include the independence of future presidents and vice presidents, the formation of an independent ethics board, and one seat each, as a minimum, for both athlete and national anti-doping organisations to have representation on all WADA committees. The way the 38-member Foundation Board works is that the presidency rotates between candidates put forward by the two sectors who fund WADA. So at the moment, the chair is Sir Craig Reedy, put forward by the IOC and sports federations. He'll be replaced when his term expires next year by one of the candidates nominated by the government officials, who contribute the other 50% of WADA's budget. Immediately following this week's meeting in Azerbaijan, I asked WADA's Director General, Olivier Nigli, whether the changes adopted would be enough to calm the recent turbulence swirling around the agency.
Well, yes, I hope so. I think today's decision on adopting governance reform should reassure, I hope, a lot of the critics we heard in the past weeks, if not months. I mean, some have been intensified recently, but I think they go in the right direction. They are a first step. There is more to be done, more to come, more discussion that we need to have with, in particular, the athletes. So, you know, it's for some, it's not enough, but a lot of what I heard and I read in the past months is in there to some extent. So I think if people look at it in a positive spirit, they should be calming the turbulence.
And I just want to ask you a little about that internally, because there's also been some friction inside the organisation, hasn't there? The Athletes Commission, the Education Commission, and we're talking well-respected athletes like Edward Moses and Becky Scott that have also been quite vocal in saying that not enough has been done to address their grievances.
Yeah, well, I think I would distinguish the two then. I think Becky and the athletes and the Athletes Commission, they want the athletes to have a more prominent position around the Exco and board table. And I think, I hope they got a little bit reassured today by the fact that everybody's actually agreed to the principle of that. There's no question. And in fact, even the government group agreed to that. The thing is, what needs to happen is that they athletes need to do a bit of homework now, and I think they agree to that too, to find mechanisms so that they can be truly representative. Because the discussion, really, to put it simply, was, okay, if we create one spot or two spots, you know, around the expo table or some spots around the board table for them, who sits there for the athletes? Who is going to be there, who is accountable, who is truly representative of them and going to have the legitimacy to speak on their behalf? And it has to be broader than the Olympic athletes. It has to be representing all continents. So they need to find a mechanism to get there, and they haven't so far. But they need to sit down and have a discussion among themselves. You know, the IOC Athletes Commission, our Athletes Commission, other groups of athletes who are representative, they need to speak together and see how this can be printed. But once this is done, once there is something that is realistic, everybody is committed to do that. When it comes to Edwin Moses, I'm afraid he has maybe somehow some views that are more representative of his country than just the view of the athletes. And I'm not sure that anything we would say, except that if we were to say that probably Russia would be banned forever, would actually appease him.
So let's talk about Russia. You have a confirmed date at the end of this month to go into Russia and the Moscow laboratory to start going through their records. Again, I guess this is where a lot of the sustained calls against WADA emanated from after it was decided that Russia could be readmitted or the Moscow lab readmitted back into the fold. So now that you have this date, does that also pacify some of those who have been critical of accepting Russia back?
Well, I mean, I want to be very prudent on the Russian file. We have a date now where we're going to have a first mission to actually organize the main mission, which will come probably a week or so after, and hopefully all this will work well, and then we will get the experts to retrieve the data. If all this happens and as planned, yes, I think this will be a good thing. This will appease things, and this will be the best thing that could have happened for the athletes. And I think people will I hope, understand it better when we can then, you know, through that start identifying those athletes that are potentially still competing and that have had positive tests in the labs. But I think these new steps need to happen. I think just having the date may not be enough yet to reduce the debate on the question. I think we had here at the board a positive discussion. I think people realize that a decision was taken. Some like it, some don't like it, but now the focus really should be on this to be delivered by the Russian and the board made a clear statement that this is now the focus is to tell the Russian that they should deliver on the promise. So we will know by 31st of December, maybe earlier, hopefully, and then we'll take it from there.
I know that your vice president, Linda Helleland, who also wants to be the next president of WADA, she's a government minister in Norway. There's been some controversy around her as well, calling for more transparency and diversity inside WADA. Do these new governance changes that you've accepted this week, do they make any changes to the potential for her to become president?
Yes and no. The governance reform that has been adopted today imposes that for the next election, whomever is going to be elected president will need to be independent. And there are a number of strict criteria that have been set in terms of not being an active minister, not being part of a government. And these criteria are pretty detailed. So in that sense, yes. I mean, clearly, whether it's Minister Helleland or the other candidates we currently have, which is Minister Bengta, both of them would have to commit not to be minister anymore as of 1 January 2020 to meet the criterion. But apart from that, I don't think what we've adopted today would have an impact on the candidates. There's no other criterion. Now, this is our criterion. This is what we have adopted. The government themselves have adopted today or have agreed to be outside of our meeting, but that's part of their own process. A number of criterion and a process on how they want to select their candidate, and that's their call. And actually, I haven't seen the detail of the criterion, but that's a separate thing for them to decide on who they want to present.
So does that mean the rotation between an IOC / sports appointed president, and then the next term is served by somebody appointed by one of the governments that are represented on your board. Is that no longer the case?
Well, that will be the case one more time. That will be the case for the next election, that the candidates will come from the public authority, the candidate for presidency, but with the criterion of independence that I just mentioned before. After this election going forward, this won't be the case anymore. And in fact, a nomination committee will search for the candidates of president and vice president. They won't be proposed by any of the two sides.
All right. Now, I'm conscious of the fact that you have just finished a long day of meetings, and it does seem like you got a lot done and you've got a flight to catch. But there's two more questions I'd like to ask you, if I can.
Sure. No,
so with this sort of sustained campaign that you've endured for the past few months, do you see that as something personal? Is this a personal attack on you, Olivier? Or do you think it's more designed at you know, towards the office of the president, which is currently held by Sir Craig Reedy?
Well, I don't like to make things personal. I'm a lawyer. I'm used to being challenged. I think it's part of the job that, you know, you are heading an organization and then people don't like what you do or challenge some of the discipline of the organization and you come under attack. I don't take it personally. I think there might be different views. I think some, unfortunately, have been personal towards the president or towards me or both. But I don't think that reflects the reality. I think the reality is that we both represent an organization. We are fulfilling our mandate. We are following the decision from the executive committee or the board. None of these decisions are of our own making. They have been taken following processes and through a democratic process. Now, when you happen to be the figure that represents the organization, you have to be ready to take the bullets.
And so the problems that have been identified or the problems that are being addressed are not personal and not personality-based, but they are to do with processes, and they are the only issues that WADA has.
Well, I would hope it's the case. I mean, maybe some people are making it personal, but, you know, I mean, I think the reality that if you look at the credit scene, normally they tend to intensify around decisions that are being taken more than anything else. Now, I think the president regularly gets criticized because he's an IOC member, and there are people saying that for that reason he's not independent. The system was designed in this way, and I don't think the current president is in a more conflicted position than the previous one or anything like that. The system was designed this way. Probably wasn't great or good idea. It was at the beginning and it's not anymore. That's why we've adopted this change in governance, and hopefully going forward this will help.
And I know that you had a briefing today also from the ITA, the new independent testing agency. I think there is still some confusion in the greater public about what is the role of the ITA? Where does it sit alongside WADA and amongst the national anti-doping organisations?
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair question. I think the ITA probably is going to have to do a better job at explaining exactly that. But the ITA is a service provider for international federation. In other words, what the ITA is going to do is organise anti-doping program for its clients, which are going to be the international federation, in the same way than other private companies do that already for some of their clients. So the ITA is not a regulator. It doesn't, in that sense, have any capacity or ambition to be a substitute to WADA or anything like that, which I hear from time to time. This is not how it has been designed. It's really there to perform the program for the federation. As far as the relation with the national anti-doping agencies are concerned, I would think that they should be good partners, because the ITA, in performing her certain services for the various federations, will need to have service provider on various parts of the world who can actually do the work and actually go and test and collect samples and so on. And the natural partner for the ITA would be the National Anti-Doping Agency, who could do that for it as part of a contractual agreement, like today. A member of the International Federation would hire a national anti-doping agency to go and test. So they should be working together in some way. And we, you know, of course, will work with the ITA in the sense that our best interest of the whole system, that the ITA perform well and good testing for the International Federation, so that they have this program in place. And therefore, it creates another layer of independence, even at the level of the first instance prosecution of cases.
So there's no reason for NADOs, for the National Anti-Doping Organisations, to fear that this is, the establishment of something that may take over or usurp what they do.
Well, I mean, no, I don't think there should be a fear of that. I mean, I can only imagine that the risk for some of them would be that some NATOs make money out of providing services and they have a new competitor on the market, if you want. In that sense, you know, that might be reducing some of their work if the ITA takes it over from the Federation and do it with another provider. But the NATOs are established mainly by governments and they have a role to play at national level within the country. So, you know, that this part of the work will never be replaced by the ITA. I mean, that's just not feasible to imagine that the ITA from central based in Lausanne would cover, you know, imagine testing national level Australian athletes.
Olivier Nigli, I do appreciate your time on The Ticket today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That's the Director General of WADA, Olivier Nigli, joining me from Azerbaijan. As we just heard from the WADA Director General, the World Anti-Doping Body has embarked on significant governance changes, and having confirmed a date with the Russian Anti-Doping Agency to sift through its records, hopefully the organisation can put turmoil of the past few months behind it. But will those calling for more significant change be satisfied? Those groups include athletes, national doping bodies such as ASADA in Australia, UCAD in the UK and USADA in the US. The calls from national doping bodies, or NADOs as they're known, prompted WADA's founding president, Canadian IOC member Dick Pound, to effectively tell them to shut up and do what they're paid to do, rather than reaching above their station. We'll hear from the head of the International Coalition of NADOs a little later. Right now, though, our panel ponders the future of WADA. Joining me today from Nyon in Switzerland, Executive Director of the World Players Association and human rights lawyer Brendan Schwab. Hi, Brendan.
Hey, Tracy.
From Stirling University in the UK, Associate Professor, Associate Dean for Internationalisation, Paul DiMeo. Hi, Paul.
Oh, hi, Tracy.
And from Loughborough University in London, PhD candidate researching the legitimacy of WADA, Daniel Reid. Daniel, nice to have you on.
Hi, Tracy. Nice to be on.
Brendan, I'm going to start with you. What we've seen since September is new ground for athletes. They've effectively found a voice that they probably haven't used in such a way before, and they've been highly critical. It would seem from this week's governance changes at WADA that their voices have been heard.
Well, if they have been heard, Tracy, they've only been heard in part. And that is because the governance reforms proposed by WADA are really the result of what WADA may describe an extensive consultative process, but really it's been a 12 to 24 month of period of political wrangling and negotiation. When we cut through all of this, it really just comes down to three issues. The first is that the governance of WADA is hopelessly conflicted. There's not a clear independent leadership in terms of the executive. The key stakeholders aren't involved in the development of the governance of WADA, particularly the promulgation of the code. We have a conflicted judicial system. And, of course, we have a lot of politics and decisions such as Russia highlight how WADA is trying to balance political issues with its mission, which, of course, is a world of sport which is free of anti-doping. So we have that conflicted governance structure. We also have the inability of the WADA system to deal with sophisticated cheating, even state-sanctioned cheating. And the third aspect is that the WADA code is so brutal in its impact on athletes. And we see so many cases of injustice, of manifestly excessive penalties on athletes who are not dopers, who are not cheats. And athletes are starting to ask themselves, well, why should we pay that price in circumstances where the governance is conflicted and the system is ineffective in dealing with the state-sanctioned and sophisticated doping, which is such a problem?
So just quickly, why do you say it has an inability to deal with that sort of state-sanctioned doping? What does it need?
Well, WADA needs to make a decision, and what we've seen, particularly in recent years, is the strong assertion on the part of the Olympic movement of its say in the governance of WADA. WADA, of course, should be an independent body that is equally accountable to the governments, the sports governing bodies and the athletes. But at the moment, it's a so-called partnership 50-50 between the sports governing bodies and the governments. The sports governing bodies are largely represented by the IOC, who's driving an agenda which ultimately must see the success of the Olympic movement. And that means that decisions such as the exclusion of Russia are decisions which are very complex political decisions. And I think that the IOC wants to make sure that it has enough control over the World Anti-Doping Agency so that its political and its commercial interests can prevail on those crucial matters.
All right, I'm going to come back to Russia, but I might bring Paul in here. Paul, do we need to separate the workings of the executive and the staff and this foundation board? And is that the problem in WADA being able to prosecute its role successfully?
Yeah, it's interesting. I thought, I have to say, Brendan's summary was absolutely perfect. WADA have always had this relationship with the IOC, and has been the case since it was first suggested as an organisation back in 1999 by the IOC. So I'm a little bit surprised in a sense that it's only now that it's taken other sports groups to say, you know, hang on, what is this relationship exactly? And the very fact that they get 50% of their funding from the IOC means that the kind of threat is always a reduction in funding. As the IOC started to develop its own anti-doping policy or to focus on its own testing system, then WADA probably wouldn't even exist. So I think the IOC has a lot of say, and it's very hard to be independent on a decision like Russia when you have a huge vested interest, a huge kind of conflict of interest within the very organisation that's supposed to be independent, transparent and working towards this clean sport vision.
Daniel, your research is really focused on this and the way that WADA is governed, its legitimacy. How do you view the changes that they've brought in this week?
I think they've made some initial good steps. So some of the decisions they've made around independence will go have sort of things that have been requested. However, I think they've decided not to make a change on athlete representation yet. So in that sense, they've really quite ignored where the main criticisms lie, because you look at a system that is meant to be designed to protect athletes and ultimately deliver clean sport for athletes, but they have absolutely no representation in it. So I think the governance changes we've seen today, uncharacteristic of WADA, but a welcome change. But I think there's still quite a long way to go in that respect.
Is an independent president going to make much of a difference?
I think it comes back to what's been previously mentioned as well, is that actually the link between the executive and foundation board is something that has very much in the past influenced this. So the fact that the executive boards are able, president and vice chair and whatever, are able to sit on the foundation board is a massive oversight and governance, because they're given a choice what should be an oversight board looking after the executive and double-checking the decisions they're making is actually not that independent. So like I say, I think the governance decisions that have gone ahead today are a good start, but there is still quite a long way to go in terms of improving democracy, improving transparency, and ultimately improving societal responsibility.
Brendan, you brought up before Russia, and that issue has really been crucial for the athletes, hasn't it? Do you see any resolution here? Do you see the athletes coming on board? Does there need to be a bit of give and take? Because I know the barrister that was running the independent compliance review told the Ticket some time ago that the situation with Russia had reached a stalemate, and that effectively this was the only workable solution to let them back in and then have access to their records ahead of December. And we hear this week that that date has now been confirmed. There will be a party that will go in on November 28.
Look, I think Russia's one of the issues. Russia has been a tipping point in highlighting the conflicted nature of the governance of WADA, but we've seen others. You know, the WADA Athlete Committee has been particularly outspoken, and Becky Scott has been a courageous and intelligent leader of the wider athlete committee on the issue of athletes and the so-called position of clean athletes. But we also saw at the World Cup, for example, the players of Australia, Denmark and France acting in solidarity with the Peruvian captain Paulo Guerrero on just how unjust his suspension was, which could have cost him a place in the FIFA World Cup. So we have this issue. What Russia demonstrates is the ineffectiveness of WADA to deal with what it was set up to do, which is sophisticated cheating. We also have what we said with Paulo Guerrero's case is players paying a price which is way, way too heavy based on the circumstances of the case, considering that player and sanctioning that player as if he was taking, for example, anabolic steroids. They're the two issues that we can't balance. And so WADA needs to be fundamentally reformed. Its executive should be completely independent. We shouldn't have one or two independent people on it. It is an integrity-based institution. We shouldn't be bargaining over positions. Its executive should be 100% independent. The legislature, the foundation board, this so-called partnership between government and sports governing bodies, that bilateral partnership needs to be replaced with a tripartite partnership, one between the athletes, the governing bodies, the sports movement, and the governments, in which each of those three key stakeholders have an equal say. We need a strict separation of powers between the legislative, the executive, and the judicial functions so that the arbitral processes can be independent as well. And finally, we need to embed the fundamental rights of athletes, a bill of rights, so to speak, in the governance of WADA so that it can't run roughshod over what we've seen. For example, the bullying of Becky Scott or the indiscriminate penalties. Those four key points are holistic reform. And I think until we see something as substantial as that, then any other talk about reform is simply window dressing and simply WADA trying to placate and manage the difficult political situation it's confronting.
Paul, you've been a long-time critic of the way WADA functions. If all of these sorts of suggestions and reform that Brendan is talking about were to go ahead, that would require significant injection of funds, wouldn't it? And given that we've already seen the conflicted nature of some of these parties and the money they give and what they expect, is it possible to find a way to make that work? I mean, who is going to fund it to the tune of many millions of dollars more?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question, and it doesn't have an obvious answer, except that if you had an organisation which included all of the athletes' bodies, as well as all the sports federations, as well as event organisers, then you know, you might not be quite so dependent upon governments and the IOC, so you could impose some sort of subsidisation kind of process.
Like an athlete levy?
Yeah, well, maybe not necessarily on athletes, but maybe on sponsors and event organisers where there's the surplus of money coming into sport. I mean, clearly, you know, got a football player in England who's just signed a contract for £300,000 a week. There's money in the system somewhere. And it has to come without any strings attached. It has to be money that flows into the system without an expectation of specific returns. I think the financing of it is one question, but I think Brendan's absolutely right. You're almost at the point where one organisation is trying to do two different things. So if they're trying really hard to stop organised cheating, that's one kind of arm of their role. But if they're trying to protect athletes and trying to have some sort of healthy system where athletes can feel as if they're getting educated, they have their rights protected, they have an appeals process which supports them, then that seems to me almost like a different function that might end up being taken on by a different organisation. So you could have an organisation that does the policy, the testing, the sanctions. You could have another organisation that does the athlete welfare and athlete representation. I think at the moment we're trying to tie everything up under one organisation, which is a huge organisation because it has all the different members, different all sports and all countries are supposed to have some sort of say in it. So it's by definition overly bureaucratic and unwieldy and doesn't actually focus on the two key things it's supposed to be able to do, which is to stop organised cheating and to protect athletes.
Brendan, do you think athletes would contribute to something like that? Like, you know, 1% of their earnings contributing to an organisation that is then, you know, holding their welfare and well-being as number one importance?
Well, the budget's $35 million. Athletes contribute to the IOC, depending on various reports, around $8 billion over a four-year cycle.
you FIFA, mean by not getting, fi- not getting paid to compete?
$5 billion over a four-year cycle. This is simply an excuse used. We've got the IOC, which operates to impose amateurism at its elite events. The Olympic Charter provides that athletes cannot be paid for participating in the Olympic Games. That generates billions and billions of dollars. And it's actually been put to me informally by people close to the movement that if the player associations were to chip in a third of the budget, then we could have a discussion about having a third of the seats on the foundation board. Like, this really can't be a negotiation about economics. The economics are ridiculous for the reasons I've just mentioned. The question is, should an organisation be able to impose a system of law on people that are not represented by that organisation? It's a foundational principle of good governance. They impose a system of law which can change the life of athletes as competitors and as human beings, and they have no representation in the making of that system of law. So it lacks legitimacy. That's why we're so strong in saying, let's make it fully independent. But in terms of ultimate ownership of this anti-doping question, who are the people who can solve this problem? And we think there's three groups: the governments, the sports governing bodies, and the athletes. It should be a tripartite partnership. And that would instill a sense of confidence on the part of athletes that we're working to solve these issues. And they are complex issues, with a genuine spirit of good faith and a commitment to actually solve them and not seem to stage manage them for other purposes.
Daniel, I know you've just returned from a Play the Game conference in Belgium where good governance in sports organisations is constantly being monitored and analysed. Was there much discussion about WADA there?
It did come up as a topic, but I think, and it sort of relates to what's already been said, is that the problem with governance in sport at the moment isn't so much that there isn't changes being made, that actually how artificial are these changes? Are they just window dressing to try and satisfy external viewers? And where is the actual motivation to keep people, keep people strict to governance principles? So, for example, if we use the recent UK Code of Good Governance, it's sort of a carrot and stick approach, really, because now they've been forced to adopt and implement across British sport Code of Good Governance. But the reality is that if they don't do this, they're going to lose their Olympic funding. And I think what we're looking at as well with WADA is that, as previously been said, it's a 50-50 partnership between the IOC. And the IOC can be seen as a dominant stakeholder by contributing over 50% compared to any other government that currently contributes to WADA. Therefore, what we need to do now is, again, to try and change this governance issue, is, like already been mentioned, is look for a new financial option that takes away the control and the sort of dependence that we see WADA now has upon the IOC. So I sort of deviate away from your question a little bit there, but that was the main concern, is that how much of the governance changes we're seeing at the moment in sport, as it is a bit of a buzzword, how much is window dressing and how much is actually going to be enforced, and how much are sports organisations motivated to carry through with what they've implied they're going to be.
And, of course, I thought it was interesting when I was speaking to the Director General, Olivier Nigli, at the completion of their session, that there was some discussion about the fact that, you know, some athletes are not represented within the athlete cohort that they deal with. And it is very specifically designed towards the IOC sports. And that cuts out a whole lot of other athletes, Brendan.
Well, it does, Tracy. The World Players Association's made up of about 120 player associations. We've calculated that we have 80,000 members who are bound by the WADA code 365 days a year. In November 2011, the WADA board met to consider the development of our organisation, and John Fay, who was then the president of WADA, said, and this is minuted, that under no circumstances would WADA recognise athlete unions as representatives of the sportsmen and women of the world. Now, this is a position that is at odds with what FIFA does, which has a relationship with FIFPro, the ICC in cricket, World Rugby. It's at odds with the way nearly all of our organisations operate at the national level. So it's incredible that WADA is worrying about athlete representation when it also has an express anti-player association policy. We've sought the opportunity to present to the WADA Foundation board, and that has been rejected. We're now being approached informally by most of the athlete committees and commissions of the world, who are now starting to recognise that they cannot influence these bodies by acting on a volunteer basis, that this is such a significant undertaking that only fully professional and representative organisations have any hope of addressing the imbalance. And the lost opportunity is this, Tracy, that if we look at a sport such as baseball, where our affiliate, the Major League Baseball Players Association, has collectively bargained anti-doping, that process of athlete engagement has been able to turn around a crisis of doping into a situation where now that sport has one of the most effective and toughest, but also legally fair, anti-doping regimes in the world.
Yeah, it's interesting when you talk about what is considered as fair, because I know there's some pretty extreme views on what is fair and what isn't. And a lot of those views actually come from Olympic athletes themselves, where there's basically a zero tolerance policy. But look, time has beaten us. I do want to finish with this. A question to each of you. If WADA did phone you this week and said, we want your number one piece of advice for a healthy future, for the sustainability of WADA going forward, what is it that you would recommend? Associate Professor from the University of Stirling in the UK, Paul DeMayo.
Yeah, good question. So I think one thing for me is about, at the moment it seems to be about athletes, having a way in which athletes could not just be represented, but be able to discuss the full range of issues of the ways in which they're affected.
All right. A PhD candidate researching the legitimacy of WADA from Loughborough University in London, Daniel Reid.
I'd like to see greater support for whistleblowers. So if we look historically at some of the major cases that have gone on with anti-doping, I think whistleblowers have been behind this huge amount of information, but actually they've been woefully treated over the years. So what we really need to look into is better support for these whistleblowers and actually mechanisms so that in the instances of the Stepanovas from Russia, who were ignored for a long time because of, as we previously mentioned, political issues, creating an independent pathway in which we can truly help get information about anti-doping out there.
And Executive Director of the World Players Association in Switzerland, Brendan Schwab.
The number one issue is governance, Tracy, and we've put forward this four-pillar reform proposal. The tripartite partnership between the governing bodies, governments and the athletes, where the athletes are represented by their legitimate representatives, a 100% independent executive, the strict separation of powers in relation to the hearing of cases, and fourthly, embedding the fundamental human rights of the athletes in accordance with the United Nations guiding principles. If those four aspects of governance reform are embraced, then we're confident that WADA can become a legitimate organisation.
I really appreciate all of you joining me on The Ticket today. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Tracy.
Thank you, Tracy.
The Ticket.
WADA says that since 2001, it has committed more than $70 million to research as it continues to find new detection methods and doping prevention strategies. But there have also been questions around how much evidence there is to support the number of substances on the banned list. For instance, when meldonium was banned on January 1, 2016, tennis player Maria Sharapova was the highest profile athlete to test positive, although there were hundreds of others. She remained one of the few to serve a suspension because it was realised adequate testing on how long meldonium stayed in the body had not been done. Many of those who tested positive took the substance while it was still legal in the closing months of 2015. This month, scientists at the Centre for Human Drug Research in the Netherlands have published their review looking at all the literature that has been published on the 23 classes of WADA-banned substances. They found only 5 classes actually have evidence of being performance-enhancing. I spoke to the senior clinical scientist at the centre, Jules Herberger.
So what we did, and maybe that's good to clarify, is to look at the literature of what has been published on effects of these substances, of any of these substances, on performance. And for regular medicines, when we're treating patients, there's a certain amount of evidence and a quality of evidence that is required before we can say that a treatment is beneficial and therefore is going to be used in patient care. And we apply that same level of evidence to all of these substances. And if you do that, then you see that there's only 5 out of 23 classes that have sufficient evidence to say that there is a beneficial effect. And these effects are only effects on strength or sprint performance, and one class for accuracy. So, for example, in shooting sports such as archery or marksmanship.
There's actually no evidence that anything really works for endurance events.
Right, that's right. So there are studies that show effects on surrogate markers for endurance. So, for example, maximal oxygen uptake, which is related to endurance performance, but that's where it becomes, well, more intricate, is that we know that it's related to performance, but if we are doing research with medicines, then we need to know that there is a clear link, a proven link between the marker and the actual endpoint that you're trying to improve. And in this case, the actual endpoint that you're trying to improve, if you were an athlete, is your endurance performance, so for example a time trial or a running distance, and there are no studies evaluating effects on those outcome measures, or there was no effect in these studies. And so the only effects that we have in some cases is the effect on a surrogate marker, of which we said in a review that's not enough to conclude that there's actually an effect on the final endpoint, which is the relevant endpoint, namely actual sports performance.
And so I'm really interested in EPO and the sport of cycling, because athletes who have doped say that they most definitely feel the difference and that they wouldn't have been able to do what they did without EPO and various other substances. So in that sense, is that a placebo effect?
That's really difficult to say, because that's something that research should point out. What we know for a fact from developing medicines is that it is impossible to determine whether there's an effect of a certain drug by asking a patient whether there is an effect. So we know that this doesn't work. It also doesn't work to ask the physician whether he thinks it works. The only method we know that gives a reliable answer to that question is to do randomized, placebo-controlled, double-blind trials. And these haven't been performed in most cases, so we just don't know the answer. These athletes that say that they felt that it worked, that may have helped them in actually perform better, and then in that case it would be possibly a placebo effect, or a real effect, but we just don't know.
And so you make the suggestion as part of your conclusion that perhaps athletes should be told of the lack of evidence of any performance enhancement for many of these substances, and that may deter them from using them.
I think at least it's useful to know for athletes, but also for spectators and for physicians, that this is the case. So we all agree that for normal medicines, you need this type of evidence, and then why wouldn't that be the case for doping? So that's one. And then the second thing is, we also want to show that actually there is a lack of evidence, and that doesn't mean that they in some cases that they don't work or that they do work, but it means that if you want to say something about it, and we want to design rules and to deter use, we should do proper research and find the evidence, And then if we find that there is no effect, that would possibly help deter athletes from using it, because then they might also understand that there's no use in taking these drugs. And if there is an effect, that's also important to know, because then we definitely know we need to make sure that we do everything to prevent them from using it or catch them if they do. But also it's useful from a scientific perspective, because that's something that's valuable and could be applied in other situations as well, apart from sports.
So you don't make the advice that perhaps some of these substances should be taken off the banned list?
Well, so we intentionally didn't include any of these suggestions, such suggestions in the piece, because the main idea we want to show is that there is a lack of evidence and there is a way to add on that evidence.
So the recommendation should be more testing.
Yeah, more research. And the other thing is we focused just on the performance part in this review, and the current anti-doping code, as it reads, says that there are three criteria to which a drug is tested. And if it meets two out of three criteria, it can be on the list. One is performance, but the second one is risk for the health of the athlete. And the third one is it's against the spirit of sport. And as we showed in the introduction of the study, the third one is a rather, well, vague or subjective criterion. Anything that you take, I would say, that you take to cheat or to improve your performance while you know it's not fair is against the spirit of sport. So you could have any one drug check that criteria. And then, of course, in terms of health, anything that you take in an overdose, even if it's water, will be a risk to your health. So the code as it reads now doesn't really enable us to say, well, you should take these drugs off. What we just want to show is that there is actually no hard evidence for most of these substances that they do work, but also that the code currently doesn't need that to put it on the list. It just says there should be some either evidence, but it could also be an idea that it might work, or physicians or staff or athletes having the idea that it works because they've experienced it.
And it makes for a rather large industry, doesn't it?
Yes. Well, I mean, sports in general, and that's also rather interesting that financially sports is huge and the money that's involved, but then in the doping industry it's actually rather limited, at least in the anti-doping industry. And so perhaps that also should be reconsidered, because one of the problems with doing such research is that there's not enough money to perform the trials. Well, perhaps we should reconsider to get some money towards those studies, because I think for any of the parties involved, the athletes, the anti-doping agencies, it would be beneficial to have at least some evidence at which they can base their decisions or their regulation.
Well, it's been fascinating speaking with you, and I'm sure we'll speak with you again when you do your next research. Thank you so much, Jules.
Thank you.
That's Jules Herberger, the senior clinical scientist at the Centre for Human Drug Research in the Netherlands.
The Ticket.
Thanks for your company on The Ticket. I'm Tracy Holmes. We leave you with this week's final minute. The Lakers' LeBron James moved into the top five scorers of all time this week. Needing just 39 points to overtake Wilt Chamberlain, he scored 44 and now has an NBA tally of 31,425 points after his 16 years at the top of the game. Revel in this. See you next week.
This guy's going to be the all-time leading scorer in NBA history, and people act like there are guys better than him at it. I mean, he passed Wilt Chamberlain last night. Next up is Michael Jordan, and LeBron's going to pass him. If you went into LeBron's database and rewired it to Mamba mentality, he would lead the NBA in scoring every single year. People have to invent subcategories for other players because they can't talk about them as the best. LeBron is Michael and Magic at the same time, and that's why every team he's on is a championship contender.
Anytime my name is mentioned, some of the greats that played this game, you know, I always think back to my hometown of where I come from, how far I've come. So That's it.
The Ticket. Actually, you know, I love talking to you.